Hello and welcome to the 8th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. This week we'll be tidying away the dirty champagne flutes and delivering our own brand of analytical Alka-Seltzer as we assess this year's Art Basel Miami Beach.
An art fair is really an opportunity for a bunch of galleries to get together and create a center of gravity.
I'll be joined in the studio by Jane Morris, editor of the Art newspaper, and art dealer and editor of Apollo magazine, Oscar Humphreys, as we muse on whether 2011 has been a good or a bad year for the world's art market.
The market does seem to have been surprisingly resilient. I mean, I think there were good sales being done in Miami.
We'll also be heading to Tidal Music in Sydney to seek out some new musical recommendations.
I've got a few favourites. Sue George, an actor. Great film called City of God. I think he got tired of that, formed a band. What a voice. What a man.
And if that weren't enough of a hearty repast for your hungry minds, we'll be finding out about Al Jazeera's new venture into the Balkans, popping along to the opening of a new Bent and Hiller Becker exhibition in Zurich, and enjoying theatre critic Matt Wolff's Book Corner. That's right here on Culture, with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. But before we get arty, let's have a little bit of music. This is New from Amy Winehouse. That was Between the Cheats by Amy Winehouse from her new Lioness record. New, or I don't know, old. New and old. Poor old Amy Winehouse. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. And thank God I'm not in the studio all alone. Today I'm joined by Jane Morris, editor of the Art newspaper, and Oscar Humphreys, editor of Apollo magazine. Both are fresh off the plane from Miami and probably in need of one very large glass of water after all those parties. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rob.
Thank you.
And is that true? I know you're both sort of straight from the plane. Thank you very much for joining us today. Now, how was Miami? Was it all about the best free drinks, or was it a place where lots of paintings and money changed hands?
Well, both, really. there were certainly a lot of parties, and I think a couple of years ago there were noticeably fewer. But the party scene seemed to be back. Well, pretty much in full swing, would you say?
Absolutely. I mean, it's the of all the fairs, it's the one that kind of combines, you know, a commercial, cultural and social life most sort of actively, in a way.
And you've said before, Oscar, that Art Basel Miami Beach, the last fair of the year, is sort of like the big end of the year, the kind of Christmas party almost, the big office party for the art world and the art market. Did it have that feeling this year? Did it feel like a sort of full stop on the year? And what sort of year was it?
I mean, it did. It, exactly as you say, it's like a Christmas party complete with, like, you know, snogging behind the water cooler.
Anyone photocopy their bum?
Probably. yeah, but that's art.
Yeah, of course. That is. I'm sorry.
They were selling that at the fair.
If you can sign it, I'll buy it.
And of course, it brought to a close a year, a good year for the art world.
Yeah. Now, Jane, would you concur on this? We spoke a little bit before we went on air, and we were wondering whether or not we could agree whether it was a good or a bad year, better than people expected, perhaps.
Yes, I think it was. I mean, there's always a sort of I suppose a truism that the general view is that the art market follows the financial markets by somewhere between a year to 18 months. And it is possible that we are seeing the end of those good times before the crunch comes. Having said that, that's not the feeling at the moment. The market does seem to have been surprisingly resilient. I mean, I think there were good sales being done in Miami. There were good sales done at Frieze. There isn't any of the signs that were happening in, say, 2008, when we suddenly felt that we were running on fumes, and Miami 2008 mm-hmm. was, I think, very bad, well, pretty much disastrous for a lot of the people, the galleries there. So, no, I think the feeling is that the art market has stayed surprisingly resilient. But, of course, that may well be because the rich are feeling very rich, you know, and that they are operating in a different level now from the rest of society, where the middle class and the working class are obviously very squeezed.
And we talked in show one, in fact, post-Frieze, we talked about you know, how you could judge the sort of health or the buoyancy of the art market by what sort of things are sold at the fairs. And we saw lots of paintings of a certain size that would possibly fit over people's mantelpieces and were not necessarily kind of pushing the envelope. What was Miami like in terms of trends, Oscar?
I mean, I think, you know, at the very top of the market, it followed what we'd seen at auction with, of the big stars being Richter, Twombly, who died this year. I think that the fair followed the auction market in that respect, and that people were chasing these extremely things that were seen as the best of their type.
Well, in order to extrapolate some of those themes a little bit more, we dispatched our correspondent Joey Daoud to Miami Basel this month, and this is what he came up with.
It's the sneak peek opening of Art Basel for collectors and VIPs. The doors have only been open for a few hours, and sales are already off to a great start.
We just started, but we already started well, so the beginning was already good.
That's Francesca Menini of Milan from her gallery, Francesca Menini. This is her first year at Art Basel Miami Beach. She's displaying a solo show along with 15 other galleries in a corner of Basel called Art Positions.
This is a special area with a 16 solo show project of artists from all over the world, from South America, from Europe, from New York, from United States. And it's only 16 artists with 16 young galleries, so it's a very special area for new proposition, for statements, for giving us statements about contemporary art.
This past weekend, the art world descended on Miami Beach for Art Basel, celebrating its 10th year.
It's the 9th time that I came to the art fair.
That's Maria Razuc, owner of a gallery that shares her name in Brazil.
Art Basel Miami is a big event. It's a very nice fair since the beginning. It was very, very good in the middle of the years. Then the change, the collectors changed. Now we see a lot of people from South America, from Latin America here. And every year is different from the other.
About 260 galleries were on display at the official Basel Fair. That's over twice as many as there were when Basel started in 2002. While the main fair is in the Miami Beach Convention Center, official Basel events could be found all over the city. There was art video displayed on the wall of the New World Center in its Soundscape Park, designed by Frank Geary, as well as public work and performances in Collins Park. Around Miami, in empty fields and parking lots, massive white tents filled the space. Basel Miami Beach attracts the largest number of satellite art fairs out of any major fair in the world. Most of these 16 satellite fairs can be found in the mainland of Miami, around the Design District and Wynwood.
An art fair is really an opportunity for a bunch of galleries to get together and create a center of gravity.
That's Cornell DeWitt, director of Pulse, one of the satellite fairs located at Ice Palace Studios.
And that's really what Pulse is all about, is that it was really started by a bunch of galleries who wanted to create something that was more friendly, more opening, more welcoming than, you know, than the large, than these enormous, very cold, sterile fairs like the larger fairs. Sales have been very good. It's, you know, in this kind of economic climate, it's always going to be a little dicey. Some of the earlier fairs in the fall were good fairs, but they haven't been quite as strong in terms of sales. But then we had some dynamite auctions in November, and that I think just gets the mood going right, and people are excited. And then we came down, and on Tuesday the Dow was up 4%. That always helps, you know. And so sales have been very, very good. People have been really pleased. There's a number of galleries that either sold out or nearly sold out their booths during the opening hours of the fair. So it's been particularly considering, you know, everything that's going on in the world. We're really quite pleased that the sales have been good, and that, you know, that helps the galleries to support their artists, and it's just a whole organic thing. So it's great that they're able to do that.
Walking down Ocean Drive or Collins Avenue, you'd see that just about any window space or empty storefront turns into an instant gallery. Some of these tiny spaces can rent for as much as $5,000 for the week. However, since Basel arrived to Miami, more permanent galleries have popped up, most of which can be found in Wynwood. While there were only three Miami galleries selected for the official Art Basel Fair, all were open and capitalizing on the flood of art-hungry traffic. Once the fairs close for the day, the parties take over, going well into the night. Panther Coffee, a local coffee shop and roaster in the heart of Wynwood, prepared for the Basel experience based on what they learned last year.
Last year was crazy. It was complete insanity. But lines out of the door all weekend long.
That's Leticia Pollock. She, along with her husband Joel, opened Panther last year, around the time of Basel.
Okay, so this year is special. Since we have everything here, we have our equipment, we have our great baristas, we just decided that since it's so busy and people are 24-hour around, that we would be open from Friday to Sunday, like nonstop. So we open at 7 in the morning on Friday, and we'll close 10 at night on Sunday. Now everybody can stop by after parties and before work.
What I love about art fairs,
Cornell DeWitt again, director of Pulse,
is that it's an opportunity to get a great distillation of everything that's going on in the art world from all corners of the globe. You can walk in here and spend a day here at Pulse and really have a great idea of what's going on all over the world in the art world. And you always end up coming out from the other side of the fair week of having a slightly improved, different type of perception of what's going on. And that's really one of the most exciting things about it.
For those of you just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Band, and that was reporter Joey Dode's take on Art Basel Miami Beach 2011. Here in the studio with me are Jane Morris, editor of the art newspaper, and Oscar Humphreys, editor of Apollo Magazine and an art dealer too. Did Joey Dode go to the right places, Oscar, when he made his report?
Yeah, that was great, except Pulse is a terrible fair. We'll forgive him.
Well, we were talking about NARD. There are 17 satellite fairs that sort of gnash away at the coattails of Art Basel Miami Beach. That's a lot of galleries. That's a lot of interest to sustain if you're there for a week. Most people are only there for a week at the most.
You can't do that.
Yeah.
Your eye can only see so much, and you get this, as we all know from going to art fairs, you get this thing where on your sort of 382nd object, you stop seeing things and your interest
wanes. You can do 382.
Or something, or 12, or 1. But no one sees that many fairs, really. And I think that, for me, the important ones are NADA, which is a new art dealers fair or something, and the design fair. But NADA's really important. It's a great young fair. It's a young fair as opposed to a fair of inferior quality, which of the other fairs are. And NADA is a place where, there's a lot of great art being made in America at the moment by young artists, and NADA is where to see it. And it really is the case that you can see things at NADA and then these artists graduate to Art Basel.
And Jane, do you find that in a year like 2011, where you said the market was surprisingly in rude health for most of the year, do people still focus on the fairs? Has it been a tougher year, do you think, for the satellite fairs? I mean, when there's 17 people trying to, make a kind of cut a dash off Art Basel, is that still surprising to find so many satellites?
Yeah, I think it is, actually. I've always been surprised by the number of them in the first place, because there is a limit to how much anyone can go and see, and there's a limit to how much there is that's worth seeing, to be honest, as well. I think that in Basel you have Lista, which is, I think, quite a good fair too. It's sort of a bit like NADA. Mm-hmm. There are actually fewer fairs in Basel, and there's still probably more than most people, mm-hmm. except the most committed, can get around. We said at the art newspaper there were 17. I think there was officially 19, but two of them we considered exhibitions. Plus, there's all the collectors who open their spaces, plus there's the museum shows. So I think almost nobody must get round all of them. And Miami is very spread out and there's no public transport, so it's not a particularly easy city to get around. I think it's generally agreed that NADA is an essential fair to see. Mm-hmm. And it's where you will find younger artists who probably will be making a name for themselves over the next few years. It's quite a fun fair as well. I mean, it's a nice fair to visit. Mm-hmm. It's not intimidating, and a lot of it's not terribly expensive.
No, if you can buy it. You know, there's that terrible thing at a fair like NADA where you've got everyone thinking that an artist is hot, where the work's $2,000, but you can't buy it because there's a list 100 people long.
Yeah, how does that work? I mean, we always kind of like talk about this stampede of billionaires at the beginning of Freeze Week or Basel.
I mean, it really happens.
Is that something that, you know, obviously, Jane, you edit the daily paper, the daily art newspaper every day at Miami Beach, just as you do in Basel and at Freeze as well. I mean, is that something that you see? Was that still on the cards this year?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think people were actually physically running as they have done in some years, which, although there was a very undignified scrum at Basel this year, which I'm sure you've all seen on YouTube, Mirabel climbing over the turnstiles. you should have a look at it. It's really very amusing. But a lot of stuff is essentially pre-sold. And that's kind of an interesting one, because the rule was always supposed to be that it wasn't. It was very apparent that people had already seen the work sent to them electronically. They were there to officially shake paws and clinch the deal, but the works weren't actually available. And you're saying at NADA that that's also... At NADA, is it that the works are not already sold, but everyone rushes for them?
There's just so much... Yeah. You know, if an artist is hot now in the art world, it just goes round the room... so quickly, and you just can't get, you know, if you look at artists like, you know, an artist like, for example, Tauber Auerbach, who's a young artist. I think she's in her very early 30s, or she's 30
like
or something.
Mid-30s, I think.
And she was in the Whitney Biennale. She's a hot artist, had some press, curators love her, collectors love her. The work, if you can get it, is $30,000 or $40,000. But because it is impossible to get, and because there is a line of 40, 50, 60 people, important, so-called important collectors who want this work, the real price is maybe 10 times that figure, because you just can't get it.
We're gonna have to sort of wrap it up here, but a quick question. Where's 2012 headed? Are you excited for it? Do you think... We always talk of it in terms of a bubble. That seems like an unfortunate analogy. Maybe we should talk about it in terms of it being a building. Is the building still being built, or is it sort of, does it need some new shingles on the roof, the art market, do you think? Jane?
Predictions are very dangerous, as she said.
Yes.
Predictions are very dangerous because it's the quickest way to look like an idiot 6 months down the line. I would say that I wouldn't want to call this one, actually. I still believe that in general, the art market does follow what happens in the wider society. But then we may be in a new era of, as I say, the rich becoming so rich and so separated from everybody else. But then what does that mean for the rest of the art system? You need young artists, you need people buying at a lower level to keep the whole ecology going.
Yeah, I mean, I think people will always buy the very, very best and young art. I worry for what's in the middle, really.
Sort of 40-year-old mid-career.
Yeah. But, you know, the art market is so broad and so international, and the art market is everything from gold ground paintings from the 1400s to contemporary Chinese art, that really it's not going to entirely collapse. I mean, a lot of people, are we fiddling while Rome burns? Perhaps we are, but I'd rather fiddle than burn.
That sounds like a good quote to end on. Oscar Humphreys, editor of Apollo, and Jane Morris, editor of the Art Newspaper. Thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. We're back with some great music just after this.
Avant-garde.
Avant-garde. I want to set up something new, not copying somebody.
Basically, we just wanted to express ourselves and don't think too much of other people.
Sometimes it needs to push a boundary.
To see the smoke clearing, but it's a lifetime thing, you know.
You actually have to find something to truly challenge, and that's an avant-garde.
Watch it on www.theavantgardediaries.com.
Section D is Monocle's weekly design show, hosted by me, Hugo MacDonald. It's a show about the things that we live with, the stories behind them, and the industries around them. From the paperclips on your desk, to the furniture in your home, the shops on your doorstep, to the signs that direct you to them.
what Japan offers up in terms of graphic design and architecture, you just cannot miss it. You have to go.
Section D is about craft, design, fashion, architecture and graphics in all their guises.
That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Now, before the break, we had our good end-of-the-year debrief after Art Basel Miami Beach, and it's just about time for a little more music. This is Not Gonna Cry, new from Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings. That was new from Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings. I'm Not Gonna Cry. You are tuned to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Still to come in part two, we're going to be finding out about Al Jazeera's latest venture in the Balkans. We'll be hopping on a plane to Australia and popping into one of our favourite little record shops, Title Music, to get some recommendations. We'll also be checking out a new Hiller Becker exhibition in Zurich and enjoying theatre critic Matt Wolfe's Book Corner. We hope there are four very good reasons to stay tuned to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Well, every week here, we deliver a hearty slice of media for you to feast on, and today we're talking news. In the 15 years since they launched, Al Jazeera have been building an increasing power base and expanding in various parts of the globe. Their most recent venture is in the Balkans, an area where traditional broadcast networks have been scaling back their coverage. We sent our reporter, Zoran Kubara, to Sarajevo to find out a bit more.
15 years after the end of the wars in the area of former Yugoslavia, Sarajevo, the capital of Bosnia and Herzegovina, is no longer the lead story in the world media. Still, on November 11, 2011, One News drew the attention of the world public to this area once again. Namely, Al Jazeera Balkans launched from their Sarajevo studio. One of the fastest-growing television networks in the world launched its first program in languages other than Arabic or English. Leila Dedic has worked for BBC World for years. Today, she's a program producer at Al Jazeera Balkans. In an interview given to Monocle, she explains why they decided to launch their first news channel in the region that has long since been abandoned by other major actors in the media business.
Well, from my personal opinion is I saw it through the media, television and newspapers and web that everybody is pulling out from this region. The answer is obvious. Economical situation is very bad in the whole Europe and the world. Al Jazeera has that lack that has money to invest in such a region that everybody pulled out. It's a great positioning for them. And also it's good for us here who got the jobs that we can now establish such a department and network. And now BBC World Service, I don't know if they will ever come back into this region, because it's not because they don't want to, maybe it's just because they don't have money to do so. And it's sad, but that's the truth of the whole process that has happened in the last 5 years. Because when I was at the BBC World Service, I remember 6 years ago when they shut down the Croatian, Slovenian, and then 6 months ago they shut Macedonian, Albanian. It's a sad situation, but we have to move on.
Dobro došli, Al Jazeera Balkans. Welcome to the Al Jazeera family.
The launching of Al Jazeera Balkans is actually a specific business strategy. It is only a step in the forthcoming expansion to a new media market, one neglected by other global media networks.
Al Jazeera Network, as far as I learned in the last 5 months, is establishing here in Balkans, and then they will have a very good opportunity to be close to Europe, but also they're opening very soon Al Jazeera Turk and Al Jazeera Swahili, which is also area that BBC, CNN and the bigger networks also pulled out. So it's a great, great position for Al Jazeera at the moment, which will, I don't know, it will make the other people a network envy, but it will give them a reflection of what they could have done if they stayed.
At Al Jazeera Balkans newsroom, they're working at full speed. This news factory attracted some famous names from surrounding countries who have decided to move to Sarajevo. Goran Milic is probably one of the most popular reporters of all time from the former Yugoslavia. Unlike when he presented news for the Joint Public Broadcasting Service of Yugoslavia, the newly emerged countries today have a completely disjointed media space. As Al Jazeera Balkans program director, he got another chance to help in overcoming of the barriers built in the last two decades.
Well, you know, the news channels are not having the top ratings. You have 1-2% and you're happy with that. CNN or BBC is the same thing. But it's serious. Al Jazeera has a serious approach. And on the other hand, there is no such a thing as a regional television. The difference now, 15 years after the war, is that we start to develop more sympathies and friendship than we had during the war, of course. And today, when Novak Djokovic is playing the finals in Wimbledon, I would say that 80% of people of former Yugoslavia are rooting for Djokovic. 15 years ago, 80% would be for Nadal.
It is obvious that launching of Al Jazeera Balkans program sets a new standard for the region's media. Goran Milic likes to think that rules of the game are being changed.
There is one thing I heard from a guy watching Al Jazeera here in Sarajevo. He said, look, Goran, I mean, I watched your news from 6 to 7, and then I quietly have my coffee. Whenever I watch other television stations, I'm mad, I'm angry, I'm somehow stimulated to be against somebody, against someone, against certain things, or either can be Americans, can be whatever, terrorists, can be Serbs, Croats, but I'm not happy after watching other television stations. Here, it's not that I'm laughing, it's not that you have a tremendously high spirit, but it's quiet, it's normal, and I'm eager to see something normal.
Well, thank you, Goran.
Thank you. And my best regards to Monocle magazine. What a magazine! Excellent.
Viewers from Macedonia are surely interested in the news from Croatia or Serbia, just as Bosnia is interested in Montenegro and vice versa. They now have an opportunity to watch a program independent from local political influences and market lobbies, and both private and public TV stations, which have been oriented to the audience in their home countries, now have competition that may make them do some serious thinking about their approach to reporting.
For Monocle, I'm Zoran Kubura in Sarajevo.
And some nice voices in that package from Zoran Kubura, especially Goran, who has such particularly good tastes from Al Jazeera, and the great phrase network envy, which I want everyone to Google. I want some emails about that. You are listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Now it's time to move from the Balkans to barbecues. I'm not saying they never slap a slice of steak over some coals in Sarajevo, but we all know it's the Aussies who do it best. For this week's independent recommendations, we're headed down under to Tidal Music in Sydney, where reporter Kate Abbasson went to say hello.
Look, it's a place where we aim to surprise people, a place where people come and are in awe of what they're surrounded by, but what they're surrounded by is something that they need to connect to, and it's something called culture. It's as simple as that. But it's not mainstream, but maybe it is. For us it is, but it's important. So I can't really say. It's a music, film, and book emporium. It's a bazaar that's a little bit bizarre as well. They'll see a Frank Sinatra CD next to a John Zorn Zadig electronic freakout. They'll see a Helmut Newton picture next to an Audrey Hepburn poster. In other words, it encompasses everything from A to Z. It doesn't exclude anyone. No specific demographic, no specific tastes, all accounted for. That's Tidal. In Australia, we're at 8 locations now, in every state, capital city, and sometimes 2 and 3 times in a capital city. But more importantly, in February, March next year, we relocate into flagship stores. In other words, we start to take up a bigger space in more prominent positions in the cities, specifically Melbourne, Sydney, and Brisbane. The reason for that is there is no reason for that, because we just want to do it, and we can. We're tastemakers, but you know, if you walk into any store, if I walk into any store, I'm surrounded by all the things that would probably live in my lounge room. So whether it's James Joyce Ulysses or whether it's Woman with the Dragon Tattoo book, it's everything that entices, interests, surprises, inspires, all of those things that have value and must have value. The store's full of great things created by wonderful artistic creatives from all over the world. And people need to connect back to those souls, you know. Well and good with the whole online discussion, but I still think people are social creatures. They're tactile people. Tactile creatures, sorry. You need to come into a social space to meet other people and relate to that on a very physical level, not a virtual level. So we offer them a very broad palette. Clearly, that's why we're moving into the bigger stores, because we need to have more things to show people, because there's so much out there. We've found that the shop at any one time can be inhabited by people who are 15 to people who are, well, some of our best customers are in their early 80s. Women in their early 80s are asking for the latest in music, which is still, by the way, our biggest selling item, music, physical music, vinyl. The new Tom Waits has attracted a lot of attention. Afro-Cubism, wonderful release on the World Circuit label. I've got a few favourites. Sue George, an actor, great film called City of God. I think he got tired of that, formed a band. What a voice. What a man. Girl, close your eyes. Let everything get into you. Don't try to fight it. There's nothing that you can do. But I'm a bit old school, you know. I'll put on Jimi Hendrix Band of Gypsies as I have all week, and that's all I listen to for a week. Culture's not dead, retail's not dead, retail's drama. We provide the theatre of the absurd down there, and people are attracted to that, and always will be. As long as you get the mix right, you present something that people are going to be inspired by or attracted to or excited by. And the moment that people lose interest in that, our public drifts away, well, then we'll close our doors too. But we'll at least have said what a long, strange trip it was.
Mr. Tidal Music there in Sydney. That was a report from Kate Abelson with some nice sound apps. Tom Waits and Afro-Cubism in there. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. We're back with an opening in Zurich after this.
Avant-garde.
Avant-garde.
I want to set up something new, not copying somebody.
Basically, we just wanted to express ourselves and don't think too much of other people.
Sometimes it needs to push a boundary.
To see the smoke clearing, but it's a lifetime thing, you know.
You actually have to find something to truly challenge, and that's an avant-garde.
Watch it on www.theavantgardediaries.com.
So The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly business briefing. We are shining a spotlight on the people around the world who are driving innovation within their industry.
I didn't set out to become a perfumer, so it's almost an accident, which doesn't sound very business-like, but it is.
So it's not about bulls and bears, it's about small businesses, it's about the businesses you've always dreamed to set up, it's about the entrepreneurs who are daring to go out there and do it.
That's The Entrepreneurs, presented in association with Pictet, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24.
You are tuned to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Now, in a career that has spanned nearly 50 years, German artists Bernd and Hille Becker have photographed landscapes that many of us wouldn't give a second glance. Mines, mills, gasworks and warehouses, the Beckers recorded it all through the consistent gaze of their lens. Their epic story of anonymous sculptures, as the Beckers called them, have been brought together in a new exhibition at the Fotomuseum in Winterthur, near Zurich. Joe Furness went to the opening night and spoke to co-curator Thomas Seeing about the role of Bernd and Hille Becker in photographic and art history.
At the time when they began their first research, this kind of photography was almost not existing. I mean, beginning of the 60s, journalism was still in favor. The big magazines were publishing. You had a very subjective way of working with photography. Steichen's Family of Men was around. So there was a lot of emotional stuff in there. But I would say that the Bechers actually were the first ones to bring back actually the notion of archival projects, like, for example, August Sander, or Eugène Jay's research on the streets of Paris, for example, but also the reference to Walker Evans with his documentary style. I think these are all things which actually added up to their work. And then through Bernd Becher's teaching the Kunstakademie in Düsseldorf to form a new generation of new photographers.
I'm Heinz Liesbrock, and I'm the director and also chief curator of the Joseph Albers Museum in Bottrop in Germany, in the Ruhr Valley. And when they photographed it, this, for example, is one. It's the coal mine Fritz Heinrich in Essen, which is very close to where my museum is, to where I live. You have the intertwining of industrial forms, of residential houses here. You have the quietness of forms, you have the quietness of light. So it was photographed in 1976, so now 35 years later, we look back to it as something that is definitely gone. It's a memory. So there is beauty, but also a slight nostalgia about it.
But you said before that you don't feel a sense of sadness from their work, but looking at this picture, that the whole foreground is dominated by this wasteland.
No, that's just the way the Ruhr area looked, and that's the way industrial districts looked all over Europe and all over the US. And for me, as somebody who grew up in the Ruhr area, what for you is a wasteland, in a way, for me, is a playground, and where life was blooming when I was a kid. And there was no strict borderline between the industrial area and those areas where we were permitted. So it's full of mystery, too. So it depends on the perspective.
Okay, my name is Hille Becher, and I'm half of a team that is Bernd Becher and Hille Becher. We have been working together since the late 50s. My husband, Bernd, died in 2007, and I go on as good as I can, and I'm still photographing, and I'm 77 now, so I go ahead as long as I can.
It's quite striking for me. For example, these two images behind us are both taken in Germany, and this one is taken in 1963, and this one is taken in the year 2000. They're so far apart in time, and yet to look at them, I wouldn't be able to put a date on them. It's almost like nothing has changed.
The method didn't change. We both agreed to use the photography method of the 19th century, a large camera. We started even with glass plates and photographed in a very distanced, almost neutral way. Although, of course, there is composition, of course, there is some craft involved. On one hand, it's like a biologist searching for beetles and finding variations of different shapes. So, but we come from the other side, we come from the visual side. And then we ask, what is the reason it looks like that in the States, and why is it different in South Wales.
In these areas, in these communities that you went into over the years, were people surprised that you were so interested, that a photographer, an artist, wanted to come and photograph these landscapes that maybe they didn't think of as being worthy of that?
Yeah, the funny thing was, in the offices, they said, "What is this all about? What's the matter with you?" But once you got into it, and the workers there, they didn't find it strange. They had this image in their head already, and so for them it was very normal. And they helped us, and they could even tell us where to go to get this special image or a special view. But the company, the big bosses, they were complicated.
They were suspicious.
Suspicious. There was a Cold War, Nazi time. There was always something. Nowadays, it's rather more insurance.
Now and at the time, do you find them beautiful?
Yes, of course they are beautiful. We constantly use this term, schön. Oh, wie schön. If you work with something, your subject is beautiful.
Well, in a way, that's the message of your, or one of the messages of your pictures, is that these buildings that were designed by people that didn't really have the aesthetic quality as their primary focus made very beautiful buildings.
Yes, these buildings are without design. I mean, there are some, sometimes you have little elements, but in all functional, really functional.
I think you've described them before as anonymous sculptures. I mean, they have this sculptural quality.
They have a sculptural quality, and they are built by anonymous builders. I mean, they're almost, you could say, plumbers in some cases.
And how would you describe your life? Would you describe yourself as a life of an artist or a social historian or an archivist? I've read all of these things about you.
I don't care, really. I don't really care. Yeah, it's my memory, my life, and my adventure.
That was German photographer Hila Bescher talking to Joe Furness at the Photo Museum in Winterthur near Zurich. And if you can't check out that show in Switzerland, then both the Tate in London and MoMA in New York have great collections of the Bescher's work. You're listening to Culture on Monocle 24. We'll be back in a sec. Thanks for tuning back in. This is me, Robert Bound, on Culture on Monocle 24. Now it's time for Book Corner, where we ask people to choose some writing they love, be it poetry, prose, journalism, or juicy recipes. It's a chance to celebrate a bit of great writing. This week, it's the turn of Matt Wolfe on last week's show, the theatre critic for the IHT. He chose to read a recent editorial from his own paper by Nicholas Kristof on whether people are getting nicer.
It's pretty easy to conclude that the world is spinning down the toilet, so let me be contrary and offer a reason to be grateful this week as we Americans celebrate Thanksgiving. Despite the gloomy mood, the historical backdrop is stunning progress in human decency over recent centuries. War is declining and humanity is becoming less violent, less racist, and less sexist. And this moral progress has accelerated in recent decades. To put it bluntly, we humans seem to be getting nicer. That's the central theme of an astonishingly good book just published by Steven Pinker, a psychology professor at Harvard, called The Better Angels of Our Nature. Today we may be living in the most peaceable era in our species' existence, Pinker writes. He describes this decline in violence as possibly, quote, the most important thing that has ever happened in human history, close quote. In a century that began with 9/11, Iraq, and Darfur, the claim that we are living in an unusually peaceful time may strike you as somewhere between hallucinatory and obscene. Still, even in a 20th century notorious for world war and genocide, only around 3% of humans died from such man-made catastrophes. In contrast, a study of Native American skeletons from hunter-gatherer societies found that some 13% had died of trauma. And in the 17th century, the 30 Years' War reduced Germany's population by as much as one-third. Wars make headlines, but there are fewer conflicts today, and they typically don't kill as many people. Many scholars have made that point, most notably Joshua S. Goldstein in his recent book, Winning the War on War, The Decline of Armed Conflict Worldwide. Goldstein also argues that it's a myth that civilians are more likely to die in modern wars. Look also at homicide rates, which are now far lower than in previous centuries. The murder rate in Britain seems to have fallen by more than 90% since the 14th century. Then there are the myriad forms of violence that were once the banal backdrop of daily life. One game in feudal Europe involved men competing to headbutt to death a cat that had been nailed alive to a post. One reason this was considered so entertaining, the possibility that it would claw out a competitor's eye. Think of fairy tales and nursery rhymes. One academic study found that modern children's television programs have 4.8 violent scenes per hour, compared with nursery rhymes with 52.2. The decline in brutality is true of other cultures as well. When I learned Chinese, I was startled to encounter ideographs like the one of a knife next to a nose. Pronounced yi, it meant cutting off a nose as punishment. That's one Chinese character that students no longer study.
That was theatre critic Matt Wolfe's book Corner on the statistics on whether or not we are in fact getting nicer. So that's just about all we have time for this week on The Culture Show. Next week we'll be having a radio special on the radio, celebrating that medium in all its glories around the world, with UK broadcasting legend Trevor Dann joining me in the studio. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Vann. My producer was Katie Bilbao and my researcher was Hannah Jenkins. And it's time for one final song this week. The Smashing Pumpkins have re-released Siamese Dream, which gives us a great excuse to play Luna. Thanks for tuning in.